1972, Joey Gallo killed in Little Italy during dinner at Umberto's Clam House.
An hour from now, be it tonight, or 100 years from now, I'm in jail. I mean,
they get there by violence, and often as not, they leave by violence.
Between $3 and $5 million in cash and valuables was taken from the Lufthansa cargo terminal out at Kennedy Airport.
I can give you guys $500,000 a year without a problem.
New York City is a war zone for mobsters and their targets.
Hello everyone, and welcome into part 4 of episode 57 of The Black Hand, an organized crime history podcast. I'm your host, Bliss Grieve, and on today's show, we continue our look into the history of deputy gangs in the LA County Sheriff's Department. Last week, we talked pretty in-depth about the rise of the Century Station Regulators, and how they led a new generation of deputy gangs that preceded the first generation gangs, like the Linwood Vikings. But in today's show, we're going to be talking about an entirely different breed of deputy gang altogether. Those that ran the county jails, like the 3000 and 2000 Boys, two closely linked groups that carried out one of the most horrifically violent campaigns of terror ever linked to deputy gangs, resulting in almost 50 reported violent incidents in just a 2-year period. Before we get started, if you want to support the show, please rate it and go follow the show's Instagram and Twitter pages at The Black Hand Pod, and please feel free to reach out. Also, consider giving a little bit to the show's Venmo at The Black Hand Pod as well. The link's in the description. But without further ado, let's get right into today's episode. To start the show, we once again have to go all the way back to Sheriff Lee Baca, because when he won a fluke election for Sheriff of Los Angeles County in 1998, there was a cultural shift within the department. Baca's predecessor, Sherman Block, kept a nonchalant attitude towards deputy gangs. But when Baca took over, he elevated prominent Linwood Viking Paul Tanaka to the position of assistant sheriff and later undersheriff, second in command of the entire department. And for some, the move signaled approval of deputy gangs and their new style of law enforcement. From his new position, Tanaka oversaw operation of the county's jails, and installed several other gang members to high-ranking positions in exchange for money and a promise to keep the code of silence. Among them was Charles McDaniel, a sergeant on the 3000 block who admitted under oath that he was inked with a skull associated with the Century Station Regulators. But under the watch of leaders like Paul Tanaka and McDaniel, Men's Central Jail, or MCJ, became the birthplace of perhaps the biggest gang within the LASD, known as the 3000 Boys. Which shouldn't be surprising, as the county jails are an ideal breeding ground for gangs. Most deputies are assigned to work in the system straight out of the academy, and sources close to jail operations say that many are eager to prove themselves. The Citizens Commission for Jail Violence found in a report on deputy gangs that the 3000 Boys have a common tattoo on the calf depicting the Roman numeral for 3, and that deputies earn their ink by beating inmates and filing false reports to cover up the abuse. The report also describes the walls of the deputy booth in the 3000 block as full of graffiti and derogatory writings, including a bumper sticker that read, quote, "Don't feed the animals." The first known incident alleging violence at the hands of the 3000 Boys occurred on April 17, 2008, when deputies Scott Erskine, James Crace, Armando Diaz, and Jonathan Pera ordered Velton Boone out of his cell and beat him. And following a lengthy investigation into the 3000 Boys, Boone settled his case before trial for $950. Then, in August 2008, Deputy Juan Abel Escalante, who worked at the Men's Central Jail, was killed by members of the Avenue Street Gang in a reported case of mistaken identity. And following Escalante's death, deputies at MCJ began beating and threatening to kill incarcerated Latinos because they incorrectly believed that one of them had put out a hit on the deputy. But following a severe attack on an incarcerated man, inmates refused to leave their cells. Body camera footage obtained by ABC shows Lieutenant Chris Blasnick, a supervisor at the jail, briefing a group of over 30 deputies and a sergeant before they unleashed a merciless 6-hour attack on the incarcerated man. Just before the incident, Heriberto Rodriguez was laying on the floor of his cell in the 3300 module, covering himself with a mattress while not responding to deputy commands. At which point, according to the complaint, several deputies fired projectiles at his leg, then entered the cell and kicked him as he lay on the floor. One deputy pulled the shirt around Rodriguez's neck and choked him until he was unconscious, before he was shocked back into consciousness with a taser, which was used on his testicles, armpits, back, and backs of his knees until its charge was extinguished. Then, one deputy applied his knee to Rodriguez's right elbow in what Rodriguez believed was an attempt to break it, while another clubbed him in the back of the head with a flashlight, leaving Rodriguez with a tablespoon-sized fracture on his skull. But he wouldn't be the only one to feel the wrath of the deputies that day. Carlos Flores was incarcerated in cell number 4 of Row A when a group of deputies approached him and fired rubber bullets. He collapsed upon impact, but the deputies who entered the cell picked him up and pinned his arms to his sides as others took turns beating him in the head with flashlights until he lost consciousness. Flores was also brought back with the shock of a taser before the deputies beat him until he lost consciousness again. Body camera footage of the extraction even shows Captain Daniel Cruz, the commanding officer of MCJ, looking on as Flores was dragged through the halls of the jail, and Flores's next memory was waking up in an emergency room. Following the attack that left him with multiple fractures to his right eye socket, requiring the placement of a metal plate, along with a fractured sinus bone and persistent seizures. Across the row from Flores, deputies doused Eric Nunez with pepper spray and hit him with what he believes to be 40mm less-than-lethal rounds and a stinger grenade. Several deputies also entered his cell, beat his upper body, and shot a taser on his legs until he lost consciousness. While in cell 12, Juan Carlos Sanchez was also hit with less-than-lethal rounds and beaten in the head with flashlights by deputies. And as deputies dragged Sanchez through the jail, he lost consciousness 3 times. Once in his cell, once just outside of it, and again in the dining hall. And when it was all said and done, in total, 19 people went to the hospital with broken bones as a result of the extraction. The victims eventually came together to file a civil rights lawsuit against the county, and they were eventually rewarded over $1 million in a jury verdict. Though appeals for the case through 2019 ran up a bill of over $7 million for the taxpayers of Los Angeles. But the LASD members involved in the incident faced no repercussions and testified as such under oath in depositions. And in fact, no one was ever contacted by internal affairs, which signaled to everyone that this sort of behavior was upheld by the department. Cruz was relieved of duty in 2011 due to his handling of several cases related to MCJ. He retired from the department in 2013 and appears to still collect a retirement pension, while Lieutenant Christopher Blaznik, who was captured on film prepping deputies before they stormed the cells, held several positions in the department following the extraction at MCJ, including captain of the Crescenta Valley Station from 2017 to 2019, before being promoted to commander of the South Patrol Division by Sheriff Alex Villanueva in 2019. But Blaznik wasn't the only one promoted in the wake of the extractions, and as of 2019, Matthew Thomas and Matt Onimus were lieutenants within the LASD, while Kelly Washington and Jose Mendoza were sergeants. Several other participants in the extraction also appear to continue to serve as deputies as recently as 2019, and in fact, at least 24 of the 30 deputies involved are still active within the department. So with no repercussions coming down as a result of their terrible violence, it wouldn't be long before the 3,000 boys were active again. And on January 18th, 2009, Bobby Willis was moved within MCJ by deputies David Aviles, Carlos Castillo, and Adrian Zuniga. During his transport, Willis complained about the handcuffs hurting his wrists and was told to shut up before being beat and kicked in the head, resulting in him receiving 4 stitches. And despite his injuries, Willis eventually lost his case in a jury trial, and it's unclear whether any of the deputies were disciplined for the incident. That same year, an ambitious 22-year-old named John Horton, who grew up in the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles, had his dreams cut short when he reported to Men's Central Jail after missing a court-ordered appointment with a drug program. He spent his last birthday in solitary confinement, and just 10 days later, he was found dead. Jail officials told his mother that her son committed suicide by hanging himself, which she immediately rejected, and the autopsy report eventually confirmed her suspicions. She says that the coroner reported damage to Horton's liver, kidney, pancreas, spleen, and pelvis. A muscle in his back was lacerated, and his head had a blood clot and knot. He was hit in the forehead with a flashlight, which left a print, twice in the side of the temple, and in the back with a flashlight right above his tailbone. There was also a large pink ring of flesh visible around Horton's wrist, which his mother says was caused by handcuffs. And likely as a result, the sheriff's department's ruling of suicide as the cause of death was eventually overturned to unknown. And by 2010, Horton's mother filed a civil rights lawsuit against the county. In court filings, deputies Christopher Kidder and William Penhollow admitted to going on a food run outside of the jail with the blessing of Sergeant Clifford Yates, who is a self-admitted Linwood Viking. Penhollow also explained that instead of performing his usual rounds, he used a barcode cheat sheet to try and document a security check. They claimed that when they returned, Horton was dead from hanging, and Penhollow says that he didn't observe anyone injure Horton at any time, but the case would settle for $2 million in 2016, which was covered by taxpayers. And Penhollow appears to be a deputy as recently as 2019, while Yates retired in 2013, and appears to be collecting a pension of over $140,000. He has also written a book titled Deputy, where he uses racist and transphobic slurs, describes instructing his subordinates to lie, and admits to committing crimes, as well as violating department procedures while on duty. Then, on July 20th, 2009, after complaining about the inhumane conditions in MCJ, Evans Tutt survived a brutal beating. In court documents, other incarcerated men described witnessing deputies Hernan Delgado, David Aviles, David Ortega, Jason Snyder, and two others calling Tut a racial slur and unleashing a brutal beating on him. They tasered, kicked, and hit a handcuffed Tut with flashlights, and by the time it was over with, his nose was broken in multiple places, a tooth was chipped, and bruises covered his head, legs, and torso. And even though Los Angeles County District Attorney Steve Cooley filed against the deputies for filing a false report, 19 of the charges were dismissed. However, Tut filed his own federal civil rights lawsuit against the county and was awarded $400,000. Shortly following the beating, Deputy David Ortega was arrested at a bar in Fullerton, California, after threatening to fight and kill the bouncer, eventually pleading no contest, serving probation, and being demoted, though he appears to have been working at MCJ as recently as 2019. And despite his legal troubles, he would be involved in yet another beating before the year was out. This one on Michael Holguin, who was incarcerated inside of MCJ in October 2009, where for 3 weeks he wasn't allowed to shower. And when he asked Deputy Rico why he wasn't able to do so, Holguin was handcuffed and taken to a secluded area where he was beaten in the head and ribs. He received 8 suture staples in the center of his head and 4 stitches to the right eyebrow, also suffering a broken tibia, for which he underwent surgery and was fitted for a cast. But upon returning to MCJ, he wasn't given crutches or a wheelchair and was placed in a cell without accessibility tools, forcing him to drag himself around, eventually resulting in Holguin settling a federal civil rights lawsuit against the county for $475,000, with county taxpayers picking up the bill. However, it wasn't long before the violence of the 3,000 boys was turned against other deputies. In 2010, the Men's Central Jail holiday party was held on December 10th at the Quiet Cannon restaurant in Montebello. And at the outset, the evening seemed to be going well enough, as the department had instructed several deputies to function as designated drivers so their colleagues could drink. But the event ended in chaos when members of the 3,000 boys brawled with fellow deputies. Deputy Christian Vasquez spent the party drinking 10 beers and a shot of alcohol, resulting in other partygoers saying that he appeared intoxicated. Vasquez, who worked in the prison visiting section, says that he had a conversation with a deputy from the 3,000 floor about how his colleagues tended to be slow at getting incarcerated men to the visiting area. And by 11 p.m., he was approached by a group of 3,000 boys in a stairwell outside of the banquet hall who asked why he was disrespecting them. Deputy Olazario Perez saw the argument and tried to intervene, but became caught up in the confrontation himself. Both Vasquez and Perez were punched repeatedly by deputies Alfonso Andrade, Hernan Delgado, Joseph Gonzalez, Christopher Hernandez, Juan Navarro, Jeffrey Rivera, Mauricio Rodriguez, and Jason Snyder. A brawl that was witnessed by over 200 people, including Captain Daniel Cruz, who ran Men's Central Jail at the time. Several photographs taken that night show the 3,000 boys flashing their gang sign before the fight. And after it jumped off, several Montebello Police Department officers reported to the Quiet Cannon in response to a 911 call and were told that their help wasn't needed, at which point the MPD officers left without any further investigation. and that was subsequent internal affairs investigation into the brawl resulted in the firing of six deputies. It's unclear if there was an appeals process which could have resulted in the reinstatement of these very same deputies. In the aftermath, Vasquez and Perez filed civil rights lawsuits alleging that the LASD was inadequate with disciplining deputies, while Jason Snyder, one of the 3,000 boys, brought another civil rights suit against Paul Tanaka, alleging retaliation. Both cases were settled, but they didn't reduce the power or influence of the growing gang, and the 3,000 boys remained intact and continued to terrorize Men's Central Jail. So by March 2011, MCJ had become synonymous with violence and torture, and the Los Angeles Times reported in 2011 that the department routinely transferred deputies convicted of crimes or found guilty of serious misconduct to the county jail as a way to keep them away from the public, making the situation in the jail even worse as a result. And on March 11th, 2011, William Tillman says that the sounds of a pornographic film coming from the deputy's control booth woke him up, which was a regular occurrence according to Tillman's complaint. Tillman saw Deputy Armando Ibarra step out of the booth before completing a security walk on the floor. And just a few days later, Anthony Brown, who was acting as a federal informant for an FBI investigation into LA County jails, approached Tillman and told him that deputies Lance Mormon and Ibarra believed that Tillman was talking bad about them. As a result, on March 25th, 2011, Deputy Mormon beat Tillman before Ibarra joined in by kicking Tillman and pepper spraying his face. Mormon then directed custody assistant Engelbert Perez to get a taser, which was deployed on Tillman's back 3 times. In the aftermath, Tillman was taken to the jail's medical clinic, where a sergeant and lieutenant interviewed him on film. And when he was asked what happened, he said, quote, "These 3,000 boys beat the shit out of me for no reason." At which point, the lieutenant ordered the videographer to shut off the camera. Afterwards, Tillman was taken to the LA County USC Medical Center and given 35 stitches to his forehead, leaving him with a permanent scar. He eventually filed a suit with the county and settled for $100,000. And when the 3,000 boys weren't busy assaulting fellow deputies, they spent their time mistreating people in MCJ who found themselves locked up on phony charges, or in some cases, even with no charges at all. According to a federal indictment, an Austrian consul general and her husband were even handcuffed and unlawfully detained by deputies when she tried to visit an Austrian citizen at the jail. Despite the fact that she was immune from arrest and prosecution, as her actions were part of her official duties. Another visitor was also falsely accused of resisting an officer and disturbing the peace after Deputy Noel Womack fractured the visitor's arm. The visitor was then handcuffed, brought into an employee break room, and shoved against a refrigerator, cutting his face in the process. He was subsequently held at MCJ for 5 days, with no charges ever being officially filed. Then, on February 26th, 2011, Gabriel Carrillo, a father of two, came to visit his incarcerated brother. But immediately upon checking in, deputies examined his identification and began whispering, according to his complaint. Before Carrillo's girlfriend dropped a cell phone on the floor, which unbeknownst to her, weren't allowed in the visiting area, at which point she was cuffed and promptly escorted to the break room, where she was interrogated about who she came to the jail with and whether they had phones as well, to which She responded that they might. So two deputies then cuffed Carrillo and escorted him back to the break room as well. Once there, they removed his girlfriend from the room, and a group of deputies, including Fernando Luviano and Susi Ayala, threw him to the floor, kicking and punching him. And when the attack ended, Carrillo was treated by paramedics and taken to an interview room where he stated that he didn't know who hit him. But the sergeant and four deputies involved crafted a cover story claiming that Carrillo tried to escape during fingerprinting and attempted to fight the group of deputies. Carrillo was charged with resisting a police officer and was even prosecuted through October 2011 when the Los Angeles County District Attorney eventually dropped the charges. Two of the deputies involved took plea deals in exchange for their testimony about the Carrillo beating. One received 6 months of house arrest, while the other got 9 months of house arrest and 640 hours of community service. Deputy Byron Dredd, who participated in the cover-up, was retried on a charge of lying to FBI agents after a jury acquitted him of conspiracy and writing a false report, eventually being sentenced to 1 year in federal prison. Eric Gonzalez was sentenced in November 2015 to 8 years in federal prison for his role in the case. Susi Ayala was sentenced to 6 years in 2019 for her role in the beating. And finally, Deputy Fernando Luviano was sentenced to 7 years in federal prison for his role in the attack on Carrillo, with Carrillo eventually filing a civil rights lawsuit against the county, which was settled for $1.2 million. But not even the U.S. Justice Department could stop the proliferation of deputy gangs. Vikings members in leadership had given their blessing, and now different sets were working together to inflict violence and terror on both incarcerated men and any deputies who dared question the gangs. In or around July 2011, Deputy Michael Rathbun was assigned to Operation Safe Jails, a gang intelligence unit within the county jails. During this time, Rathbun worked with Deputy James Sexton, whose father served as a chief within the department. Rathbun and Sexton specialized in turning members of white supremacist gangs into informants. And in August 2011, Lieutenant Greg Thompson, their boss and a tattooed Viking, ordered the two deputies and other members of OSJ to transfer and hide Anthony Brown, an incarcerated man acting as an informant for the FBI. The orders came directly from Sheriff Lee Baca and Undersheriff Paul Tanaka, and years later would land them both in federal prison for obstructing justice. In February 2012, one of Rathbun and Sexton's informants told them that Deputy Joseph Britton was allegedly passing information to Charles Reimer, the top white supremacist shot caller in the county jail system. In exchange for information, Reimer promised Britton free tattoos at his shop in the West Valley. According to Rathbun and Sexton's complaint, their suspicions were detailed in a memo to Thompson, who promptly informed Britton, which gave him a chance to cover his tracks, blowing his informant's cover. But once Rathbun and Sexton's informant's cover was blown, he was moved out of protective custody and into general population, where he was vulnerable. And soon after the transfer, someone tried to shank him in the showers. The OSJ team had no explanation for why the man was moved, but Sexton was later told that it was meant to be a message from Thompson, their boss, that bad things would happen if Rathbun and Sexton didn't drop their complaint about the relationship between deputies and white supremacists. And shortly afterward, a confidential interview featuring Sexton mysteriously appeared on YouTube, though Thompson refused to investigate. Thompson also found out that Sexton received a call from the Los Angeles Times and told him that there would be serious consequences for speaking to the press. The intimidation continued, however, when Rathbun received white supremacist literature at his home, and another OSJ deputy told Sexton that he needed to keep his mouth shut about Thompson and Britain. Thompson's son, who was also a deputy, repeatedly threatened them both as well, and though the department's internal affairs finally began looking into the claims, the investigators maintained regular contact with Thompson about their moves. Sexton was contacted in May 2012 by an internal criminal investigation bureau investigator named No Garcias, a reported Century Station regulator. And Sexton says in his complaint that he believed this was his retaliation for his whistleblowing. He also learned that one of his informants was routinely beaten by Deputy Michael Camacho, resulting in Sexton and Rathbun meeting with Sheriff Lee Baca as a final means for relief, which came to nothing. So in 2012, the two began working with the FBI to report the LASD's violations of both state and federal laws. Following their cooperation, Rathbun was suspended without pay, and Sexton was harassed by various deputies, including Vikings associate Gutierrez, while Thompson was transferred to a coveted position in the narcotics division. And shortly after, Baca summoned Rathbun and Sexton to his office, where they expressed that they feared for their safety, which Baca minimized. Then, in August 2012, Rathbun and Sexton testified before a grand jury in a case that resulted in charges against 18 LASD members for jail abuse. Following that, Sexton was advised by another deputy not to enter the Temple Station for his safety. Once again, he was cornered by Deputy Thompson, who was allegedly sent by Baca and Tanaka. While Deputies Mazzo and Gerald Smith both told Sexton and Rathbun that they would be physically harmed if they didn't stop whistleblowing. Several high-ranking LASD officials even expressed concern that Lieutenant Thompson would try to kill the pair. Then, their personnel files, which are generally only accessible by LASD officials, were publicly disseminated, and Rathbun was also recommended for termination. As a result, they both filed civil rights complaints, which were still ongoing as of 2021. But Sexton was later convicted of obstruction of justice for his role in helping to hide federal informant Anthony Brown, while many of the very people they reported continue to serve in the department as recently as 2019, including deputies Joseph Britton, Michael Camacho, Matthew Thompson, Mickey Monzo, and Gerard Smith. Internal investigator and alleged regulator No Garcias was promoted to lieutenant in 2013 following these incidents and held the position as recently as 2019, while Gregory Thompson retired in 2013 and was sentenced for his role in obstructing justice in the FBI's investigation. He retired from the department and appears to collect a pension, as is former commander Paul Pietrantoni. But even as the situation wrapped up, the influence of the 3000 Boys would lead to the creation of yet another deputy gang. And according to the 2012 Citizens Commission of Jail Violence Report, the 2000 Boys is a deputy gang based on the 2000 block of Men's Central Jail. Like the 3000 Boys, they shared a common tattoo on the calf depicting the Roman numeral for 2, earned by beating inmates in their custody and then filing false reports to cover up the abuse. One deputy on the 2000 block even fractured the orbital bone of a non-combative inmate to earn his tattoo. And before long, the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California filed a federal civil rights complaint on behalf of two incarcerated men who were beaten and threatened by the 2000 boys. Alex Rosas and Jonathan Goodwin also witnessed other men abused by the deputies. Several people working or incarcerated in the jail also reported years of incidents of violence that they witnessed to the ACLU. To start, on October 10th, 2003, Maria Ochoa witnessed a group of deputies beating a man suffering from mental illness, which left the man with his eyes swollen shut. And in June 2006, at Twin Towers, a deputy escorting a group of inmates, including Frank Mendoza, made homophobic comments before grabbing Mendoza, shoving him against the wall, and threatening him. Later that night, the deputy both physically and sexually assaulted Mendoza, who was found naked and shivering in his cell by another deputy who asked him what was wrong. But when Mendoza reported that he had been assaulted by another deputy, the employee said that he didn't see anything wrong with him. And it wasn't until 2013 that the Office of Independent Review, a civilian oversight group that monitored the LASD from 2001 through July 2014, received Mendoza's case. According to the report, Mendoza filed an alleged use of force complaint with a watch commander who told investigators that she believed Mendoza had mistaken a routine search for a sexual assault. So she didn't conduct a sexual assault investigation nor generate a criminal report. Mendoza wasn't even interviewed about the attack, and no forensic evidence was gathered. And when an internal task force was led in 2012 to investigate claims reported to the ACLU for criminal charges, the district attorney declined to file. The case was instead referred to the department's internal affairs, but because it was reported after the one-year statute of limitations for internal investigations, no disciplinary action was taken, and the gang's violence continued. In February 2008, after Peter Johnson, who uses a wheelchair, complained about jail conditions, deputies Ochoa, Reynoso, and Saldivar pulled him off his bed and kicked him in the ribs, back, and neck, with the deputies later shooting pepper spray in his face while knocking him out of his wheelchair. Then, in October 2008, Deputy Cinderelli handcuffed Trey Quinn Johnson to transport him to a legal visit before he stopped in the hallway near Deputy Grant, who is considered a rookie deputy. Cinderelli essentially told Grant to use Johnson as his first use of force incident, making his bones in the world of deputy gangs. At which point, Cinderelli shoved Johnson against the wall and punched him, before Grant and two other deputies came over and joined the beating. The deputies also shot Johnson with a taser twice in his arm, an attack that left Johnson unable to see out of his left eye for almost 2 weeks. In February 2009, a jail chaplain named Paulina Juarez witnessed a beating on the 3000 block in Men's Central Jail where a man was knocked unconscious. One deputy noticed Juarez watching and motioned to the others to stop, but others arrived and joined the attack. So Juarez wrote a report of the beating and passed it on to both a sergeant and his supervisor at the Archdiocese. He was interviewed by the LASD, but didn't hear back about the case for 2 years, until June 2011, when Juarez attended a meeting with employees of the Archdiocese and personnel from the Office of Internal Revenue and was informed that the case was resolved internally. But the following month, Sheriff Lee Baca told Juarez that his report wasn't included in the department's file on the incident, which described the chaplain as exaggerating the details of the beating. Though in 2016, two deputies were convicted for their role in the attack. Joey Aguilar was sentenced to 18 months in federal prison, and Mariano Ramirez to 13 months for falsifying reports with the intent to obstruct justice. And while all these incidents were going on, a civilian volunteer named Scott Budnick, who mentored young inmates, witnessed 5 deputy-on-inmate beatings at Men's Central Jail from 2007 to 2009. So Budnick reported a July 2009 incident to Sergeant Renfro, who promised to get into it as soon as possible. Budnick, however, was never interviewed about the meeting he witnessed, and he never heard back from the sergeant or anyone else at the LASD or OIR about an investigation into his allegations of deputy violence. And with this continued neglect, the violence likewise continued, and in 2010, there would be 25 separate incidents of violence, and those are just the ones that were reported, ranging from abusive verbal confrontations, inmates getting banged around, and the horrific, full-blown beatings that were continually carried out and left inmates with gruesome injuries, followed by another 18, possibly even more violent incidents in 2011. But the first significant legal action that resulted from these attacks ironically came in December 2011, when retired commander Robert Olmstead, formerly the captain in charge of Men's Central Jail, before promotion to commander in the LASD's custody division, publicly disclosed that Sheriff Baca and other senior department officials, including Undersheriff Paul Tanaka, long had knowledge of the pattern of widespread deputy violence in the county jails. The Baca, of course, never followed up, and the ACLU's case eventually settled for a sum of nearly $1 million paid to the plaintiffs by taxpayers. But not everyone that challenged the jail's deputy gangs in court was successful. On December 11, 2011, Alquan Jackson was transferred to a new module within MCJ and subjected to a property search where some of his belongings were unjustifiably taken. And after protesting this treatment, deputies Patrick Rivera, Agustin de la Torre, Samuel Aldama, Jason Rodriguez, and Kevin Etheridge beat him, while at least another 7 deputies stood by and watched during the attack. After the beating, Jackson was seen by doctors and then interviewed by Watch Commander Tracy Stewart, Lieutenant Edwin Alvarez, and Supervising Sergeant Nicole Zonver, and taken to disciplinary detention. But in the aftermath, the LASD personnel allegedly conspired to report Jackson for assaulting a deputy, despite the fact that video footage captured the incident. And though these charges against him were dismissed, so was Jackson's federal civil rights lawsuit. And more than that, almost all of those involved are still deputies, while some have even received promotions to lieutenant. But that's really all I have for you guys today. I hope you all thoroughly enjoyed today's show, and tune back in next week for part 5 of episode 57, where we'll talk about the rise of the third, and really last generation of deputy gangs in the department, including the Spartans and Cowboys, who had paved the way for the most notorious deputy gangs still operating in the department today. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating and follow the show's Instagram and Twitter pages at The Black Ham Pod. And feel free to reach out with feedback, suggestions, and comments. Also, please consider giving a little bit to the show's Venmo at The Black Ham Pod as well. But with that said, I hope you all have a great rest of your day. This is your host, Bliss Grieve, signing out.